Flood on the Goodwins. A.D. Divine. Dundas looked out into the fog and blew reflectively on his fingertips. The night was cold, raw with the steady drift of the westerly wind, and the fog poured over the dark bulk of the harbour wall as floodwater pours over a breach in the dikes, as evenly, as endlessly, as ominously. The last greyness was fading out of it now, and within 20 minutes at the outside the night would be down, and the sea as lost as the black earth in a snowdrift. Dundas blew again, not a night for fishing, he decided, not even for wartime fishing, when food was scarce and prices high. The complete darkness of the harbour was daunting. No light showed even on a clear night now, save when the immediate necessities of shipping demanded it. Even to find one's way through the narrow entrance was a matter of caution and skill. Dundas knew that he could do it despite the fog, but whether he could find his way home again was another matter, and this fog might easily be a 2-day affair. It was not as if he were a regular local fisherman, though heaven knew even the locals had not gone out this night. Dundas was a deep-sea man, third mate he had been when the war began, third mate on the Rosvian, 5,000 tons, flush-decked, running regularly like a ferry in the Rio Plata maize trade. In the May of 1917, he had watched the Rosvian sink off the Casquet. The incident had made a considerable impression on him, but had in no way affected his nerves. His principal reaction had been largely one of scorn at the poorness of the shooting of the submarine which had put them down. In the July, he went down with his next ship, the Moresby, because the torpedo gave them rather less warning than the gun of the previous sinking. He was picked up after 2 hours by a destroyer, and her commander commended him on his swimming ability. That left him with nothing worse than a cold in the head, and at the end of July he signed on again. By this time he had won promotion. He signed on as second mate. His new office lasted precisely 7 hours, allowing for 3 hours in dock before the ship sailed. Off Selsey Bill, he being then on the poop supervising the readjustment of a hatch tarpaulin, the ship was struck just forward of the engine room by a mine. The explosion cracked 5 ribs, dislocated his shoulder, and 3 parts drowned him. After he was brought ashore, the doctors told him to take it easy for at least a month. By way of taking it easy, he went down to Ramsgate, where his uncle had one of the new motor fishing boats. After 5 days of his aunt's cooking, he began to get restless for the sea again. After 7 days, he was skipper of his uncle's fishing boat, and his uncle was taking a holiday. It was a small boat, 18 feet long, open, with the engine under a little dog kennel cover, and no particular virtues. Tonight the engine had been sulky, diffident over starting, and secretive about its disabilities. Dundas was inclined to thank it. If the engine had started easily, he would now be out in the very thick of the fog. When he came down to the dock, there had been little sign that it would close down on them suddenly an hour later. He bent down after a moment's rest and began tinkering with it again. He had found the trouble, dirt in the magneto, and nothing remained now but to put the pieces together again. The lantern he was working by made a pleasant pool of reddish light in the wide blackness about him. There was little more to do now. He felt curiously alone, save for the steady lap and splash of the water against the sides of the boat and the stone of the wall. The night was empty of sound. Even the low chorus of bellows and wails and grunts that normally accompanies a channel fog was absent. He finished piecing the engine together, replaced the cover, rolled the strap round the groove, and giving a mighty heave, jerked it into sudden life. After a moment, he throttled down and listened contentedly to the steady purring. Above him, a voice spoke suddenly. It was an educated voice, pleasant, with a faint burr to it. "May I come aboard?" said the unknown.
"Who are you?"
said Dundas, startled suddenly out of the calm emptiness that had enclosed him.
"Cudmore's my name," said the unknown. "I'm from the minesweeper down the wall, taking a breather before turning in." "Mind the weed on the ladder as you come down," said Dundas.
The unknown came slowly down, a pair of long legs coming first into the glow of the lamp, followed gradually by a long body. The unknown wore a heavy overcoat, which appeared to impede somewhat his freedom of action.
"Been having trouble with that," he said, indicating the engine. "I heard you cursing when I passed a few minutes ago." "Yes," said Dundas. "She's a bitch, she is, but I think I fixed her."
"Going sweetly now," said the unknown.
"Yes," said Dundas. "What can you get out of her?"
7 knots or thereabouts," said Dundas.
"And what's her range with full tanks?"
80 miles or so, I suppose,"
said Dundas.
I've never tried her out, really.
Tank's full now, said the stranger.
Yes, her.
Dundas's tone suddenly changed.
May I ask why you were cross-examining me like this?
Forgive me, said the stranger, but can you keep your mouth shut?
I suppose so.
What is it? As a matter of fact, said the stranger, I'm a member of the Naval Intelligence Service, and it is urgently necessary that I should be landed on the Belgian coast tonight. Almost anywhere along the coast will do, as long as it's clear of the German lines. I've an extraordinarily important job on hand, and it's got to be done in complete secrecy. Dundas lifted his face away from the glow of the lamp. Question of getting close enough in. You know the Belgian coast, I suppose. You know how it shoals. Difficult to get a destroyer close enough in to land me with comfort. The size is against it, too. She might be easily seen by shore posts. It is essential that I should go by a small boat. As a matter of fact, the sweeper up the wall was to have taken me along, but she developed engine room defects. That's why I came along to see if there was any possibility up here. They told me there was a motorboat here. I came along, missed you the first time, and then found you by the noise of your engine.
You said you heard me the first time, said Dundas. Heard me swearing.
Oh, yes, said the stranger. I heard somebody swearing, but I didn't know it was you. As a matter of fact, I went along to another boat up there, and they told me you were farther back.
And that, said Dundas, feeling in the dark for a screw wrench, proves you to be a lawyer, for there was only Terrace up the wall, and he called goodnight to me an hour ago. Your story's a lot of bull. You're coming along with me to the sweeper now.
I was wondering how long you'd take to see through it, said the stranger coolly. No, don't move. I've got my foot on the monkey wrench, and I've got you covered with a fairly large caliber revolver. Now listen to me.
You swine, said Dundas provocatively.
No, you don't, said the stranger. Keep absolutely still, because I shall shoot you if you make the slightest movement, and I can hardly miss. I use soft-nose bullets, too. Listen, I'm going to make you a fair offer. I want to charter this boat. It's absolutely necessary that I should charter it, and if you want it back, you'll have to come with me. I've got to get to Bruges before 10 o'clock tomorrow, and that means I've got to be on the Belgian coast by dawn. This boat can do it, and this fog makes it possible. If you'll take me there, I'll give you £60 in £1 notes. It's all I've got. If you won't do it, I'm going to shoot you now and make a run for it myself. I can find my way out of this tin-pot basin, and I guess I can find the Belgian coast by myself. It's a fine night for yachting. The stranger used the same tone as he had used in the early stages of his conversation, but a faint overtone of menace had crept into it. Dundas, thinking as swiftly as the other talked, decided that he meant what he said.
"You wouldn't dare," said he after a moment. "The shot would rouse the whole harbor, and the sentries on the wall would get you long before you could clear the entrance."
"In this fog," said the stranger scornfully, "I'll take the chance."
"There's a boom across the mouth," said Dundas.
"That's an afterthought," said the stranger equably. "I don't blame you. I'd lie myself if I were in your position. But it isn't any use, you know. Are you going to accept my offer?"
"No," said Dundas.
He thought rapidly for a moment. If he could edge back slowly, he could perhaps slip the tiller out of its socket, and hitting it blindly in the dark, knock the other out of the boat. The stranger seemed to be able to read his mind.
"No, you don't," he said. "If you edge back another inch, I'll shoot, and I don't mind telling you that I'm a prize winner at revolver shooting." "Give me a minute to think it over," said Dundas.
"I will if you turn around with your back to me. Do it slowly now. If you move too quickly, I'll shoot." Dundas moved slowly around, shuffling cautiously on the floorboards. Immediately he felt something prod him in the back.
"This bullet will rip your spine clear out," said the stranger softly. "I warn you to make up your mind quickly. If this fog clears, I'm done for, you see, and I'm not taking any risks."
Dundas trod his mind as a squirrel treads its mill, but no help came. It was clear that this man was desperate. Whatever he had done, whatever he wanted to do, it was sufficiently obvious that he was prepared to risk his own life. It was equally obvious that he would not allow the life of any other to obstruct his purpose.
"Come on," said the stranger again. £60 is £60 to a fisherman, and the season's bad, I know. Heroics won't help you if you're a corpse. Better take my offer and keep your mouth shut about it. Nobody will know. You can say you got lost in the fog and couldn't get home again. Engine broke down or something. Any tale. Come on."
Can you give me any help when we get near the Belgian coast? Said Dundas suddenly. I don't know the marks. Good man, said the stranger. Then you'll do it. No, I shan't be able to help you much. I don't know much about it. Oh, well, said Dundas slowly. Doesn't seem as if I've any choice, and I don't suppose it'll do much harm. That's right, said the stranger. That's splendid. Shall we unloosen the ropes? Cast off, yes. Just a minute. Let me light the binnacle lamp. It'll be no joke working through in the fog, you know. I know, said the other, but I've been waiting for a fog for a whole week now. Dundas knelt down and, striking a match, lit the tiny lamp of the boat compass that he carried. The green card shone wanly in its glow. He could feel the muzzle of the stranger's revolver still pressed against his back. Sorry, said the other, but I must safeguard myself till we're out of the harbor anyway. Fumbling, Dundas cleared the mooring lines, and the boat drifted away from the wall. Immediately, she was lost to the world. Dundas jerked at the starting strap, and the engine came throatily to life. Foam swirled under the stern of the boat, and she surged forward through the unseen water. The fog dragged past them, faintly gold in the light of the lamp. "We'll have that out," said Dundas after a moment. "The visibility's impossible as it is." The stranger had squatted himself down next to the engine casing on the starboard side. He stretched out and grasped the lamp, found the wick lever, and turned it out. They went on into the blackness, with only the faint green eye of the binnacle making any sign of life in it at all. After a minute or two, Dundas put down the helm gently. "We are to make the entrance now," he said. The boat lifted to a little swell in immediate answer, and there was a momentary glance of a high black wall. From its top, someone challenged, and Dundas answered, giving his name and the name of the boat. The next instant, they were outside in the live water, pitching a little to the lop that came up from the downs. "Ah," said the stranger, relaxing, "and that's that. Now you play me straight, young fellow, and you'll be 60 pounds the richer. How soon can we get across? It's about 55 miles, I should say. That's 7 hours by this boat." Dundas shrugged in the darkness. "It's 65 miles as the crow flies. We'll have to reckon with the tides, though." "When's high tide?" said the stranger. "High tide? Oh, you mean the flood? Well, I'm not exactly sure," said Dundas slowly. "I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'll go south and a little east now and round the heel of the Goodwins and then stand out with the flood and get right across. With luck, we'll make it by 2 o'clock. "That'll suit me," said the stranger. "But if I not go straight?" "Well, you see, this is an underpowered boat," said Dundas slowly. "Don't you know anything about the sea?" "Nothing," said the other airily. "I was in the cavalry." "The Uhlans," said Dundas swiftly. "Don't ask questions, my little friend. You look after your steering." He settled himself more comfortably. "Remember," he added after a moment, "I still have my revolver in my hand. If you betray me, take me up to one of your patrol ships or anything. We'll both die." Dundas grunted and peered into the binnacle. For a long hour there was silence, only the steady mutter of the engine and the occasional lift and rattle of the screw in the stern glands broke across the silence of the night. Water noises from the bow and the lap-lap along the sides were somehow merged in the immense silence of the sea. Only once, far away, they heard a bellboy, and once the clatter of a ship's bell at anchor. At the end of the hour, Dundas spoke again. "We will have cleared the Goodwins now," he said. "I'm going to stand out across the heel of them. I'd like to see the course we're making." "How?" said the other. "Look at the compass," said Dundas. "And bring my head in front of you with my back to you," said the other. "No, no, my little friend. Remember only that I have my revolver and the soft-nosed bullets, and that if I die, you die too. The steering is your business, so long as you remember that." Dundas grunted again and shifted his helm very slightly. For another hour they held on in silence, then Dundas heard a slight noise from forward, a faint, rasping noise. A moment later it came again, an unmistakable snore. He nodded grimly to himself. The snoring went on, grew louder, became more steady, more settled. It was plain that the stranger was fast asleep. For 3 hours it went on, varied occasionally by little grunts and slight pauses following a change of position.
Dundas occupied himself steadily with his helm, making tiny alterations of course from time to time, checking them carefully with a great silver watch that he held in the light of the binnacle lamp. Quarter of an hour before midnight, the stranger awoke. Dundas felt the jerk as he straightened up hurriedly.
"You've been asleep," he said quietly, "for a long time."
The other muttered incoherently for a moment and then said yes. Presently, the implications seemed to strike him.
"Had you tried nothing? No, no funny business."
He paused.
"That was good," he said. "You are being sensible, my young friend. £60 is £60. Ach, I was tired. 3 days and three nights without sleep, most of them spent in the fields of the wretched country behind Ramsgate. Lieber Gott, I was tired." 3 days and three nights. That's since Monday, then."
"Yes," said the other.
"Monday was the day of the big explosion."
"What of it?" said the other.
"You?"
"Partly," said the other cynically. "Since you are being sensible, it does not matter if you know."
"But you are English, aren't you? Your voice—"
"Come, come," said the stranger. "I was at an English school, but you knew from the start."
"I suppose so," said Dundas grudgingly.
"And how near are we?"
"Not far now," said Dundas. "We should get there a little earlier than I thought. 1:30, perhaps."
"Good," said the German. With long spells of silence and occasional brief conversations, they pressed on through the night. Once or twice, the fog thinned slightly so that they could see a boat's length from them over the darkling water. Twice, Dundas tried to get the German to tell him why he had to be at Bruges in so painful a hurry, but the other avoided his questions adroitly. Every now and then, he seemed to be listening.
"Strange," he said once. "Strange, we should have heard the sound of the guns by now." "Nothing strange in fog," said Dundas. "You can hear something that's miles away sometimes, and another time miss a fog gun when you're right on top of it."
The night was getting on now. When Dundas next looked at his watch, it was 1:15.
"We should be very nearly there," he said. "Can you take a sounding?"
"What do I do?" said the other.
"Feel in the locker to your right and see if you can find a fishing line with a lead," said Dundas. "I'll slow down and you throw it ahead of you. Feel when it touches the bottom and then measure it with your arms outstretched."
The other fumbled for a bit, experimented once, and then after a second cast said,
9 times. "Call it 8 fathoms, said Dundas. "We're closing in on the coast."
5 minutes later he slowed for another cast.
6 times, said the German. "Getting there, we're inside the 5-fathom line.
5 minutes later, they heard the sound of little seas on sand, a soft rustle that was yet loud enough to come over the noise of the engine and the rustle and rush of their progress. Somewhere in the darkness, a sleepy gull called.
"We're there," said Dundas, whispering. "Get ready."
The other stood up, wrapping his coat about him. Even as he did so, Dundas switched off the engine, and in absolute silence they glided in. Suddenly the boat grated, dragged forward, and grated again. The German lurched, steadying himself with a hand on the thwart, and said,
"Lieber Gott!" "The money," said Dundas.
"But yes," said the German, fumbling in his pocket.
"You are sure this is Belgium?"
"By the distance we've run," said Dundas, "and the time, it must be."
"Ah," said the other, "take it."
Dundas met the other's hand and took a rolled bundle of notes.
"Thank you," he said. "Get out over the bows. There'll be a little more than 1 foot of water, and give me a shove off before you go. I must get afloat again."
The other lumbered over the side, splashed for a moment, and then, bending down, heaved. The boat slid astern, Dundas pushing on the other side with the loom of an oar. In a moment, it floated free, surging back into deepish water. Dundas straightened himself, the starting strap in his hand.
"High tide's at 3,
he called out loudly. He heard the other splash through the shallows, and then a scrunch as he reached the dry sand beyond. A voice came clear out of the fog to him.
"What's that?"
He heard the feet run on, scrunching over the sand, and then stop suddenly. The voice came out to him again.
"There's water here, a strip of sand, and then—"
"High tide's at 3,
shouted Dundas again.
"But the good winds are covered before the flood."
He bent down and jerked at the starting strap, and the engine woke to life. Sitting down, he headed the boat round until her bows pointed a little west of north. Swiftly, he crossed the 4-mile circle of water inside the Goodwin sands that he had thrashed round and round so many times during the long night. There were 6 miles between home and the neck of the South Goodwins, upon which a lone man stood watching the slow, relentless upward movement of the tide.
30 dead in the big explosion, said Dundas softly to himself. Women too. Well, he fingered the roll of notes. Dirty money's as good as clean to the Red Cross Fund, and the Goodwins pay for all.